Jill Wolf, 34 years old, January 15th, 2014, Chicago Cultural Center, and I am a fellow hepatitis C advocate.
Kim Morielli McAuliffe, 39, January 15th, 2014, Chicago Cultural Center, hepatitis C advocate and spouse to Michael McAuliffe.
Michael McAuliffe, 50, January 15th, 2014, Chicago Cultural Center. I'm here to talk about hepatitis C, state representative of the 20th District, and here with my wife, Kim.
So, Kim, what's your relationship to the hepatitis C virus, otherwise known as HCV or Hep C?
It's a very personal relationship. My father passed away from complications stemming from hepatitis C. It'll be 2 years in April that he will have passed. We found out that he had hepatitis C at a point to where there was nothing that we could do about it. So my hope is that we can, through talking about this, raise awareness so the public can be armed with the information they need to make educated and smart decisions. I think that will ultimately save lives.
And what do you mean there was nothing you could do about it? He had Hep C, but there was nothing you could do.
Well, there's a point when you, if you detect hepatitis C early enough, you can be cured. So that's really the key to all this, is making sure that you find out early and you do something about it. We found out at a point where there was nothing that we could do about it because it had already developed into cancer and then ultimately liver failure, organ failure, and then death. My dad found out he had hepatitis C probably 10 years ago from his primary physician, but it was never followed up on. It was like, you have hepatitis C, okay. And he went home and went about his day-to-day life. And nothing really changed. So there really wasn't an education component to what hepatitis C was. He'd mentioned it to my brothers and I, and, you know, we're educated people. And we thought, okay, if hepatitis C, you know, what does that mean? We had no idea that it could lead to all of the things that it led to and taking us down this path. It was very, very sad and very painful for him and for his whole entire family. So I think the lesson learned, not that we can bring anybody back, obviously that's passed away, but the lesson learned is that, you know, if there's something that you can fix, do what you need to do to fix it. And I think that, again, hopefully by doing things like this, we'll let people know what some of the risk factors are and educate the public.
Why do you think there was a severe lack of education when your father found out at that time?
Well, you know, I know there was, and I think, you know, the CDC has talked about some of the problems with hepatitis C. And, you know, I think the statistics speak for themselves. Roughly 75% of people infected with HIV know they have it. It's the exact opposite with hepatitis C. Only 25% of the population knows that they're infected. That's a problem because potentially we could eradicate hepatitis C from life, from our vocabulary. But not with the lack of education that's out there right now, because if you don't know you have it, if you don't know that you're in the at-risk group, if you don't know that you could have been exposed to it, then there's no way that we're ever going to fix this. And some of the ways people get it, I mean, blood transfusions, prior to 1992. Maybe you were in the hospital delivering a baby. Maybe you had surgery. Maybe you were in a car accident. They didn't really test for hepatitis C, HCV, before 1992, so there's the chance that you have contracted it that way. Vietnam era veterans are at especially high risk for hepatitis C. I mean, our veterans, because when they were in the service, inoculations in that time weren't sterile. So instead of having a new needle for every single person that was inoculated, they literally lined you up. And if you watch any of the movies that show the old war movies, they lined them up and they went down the line and they just inoculate them one after the other.
So they didn't use universal precautions
at
that point. And so they wouldn't change the needle. In the cases of blood donation or plasma, the actual machines that were processing the blood to take the plasma out and actually would bring it back into the body actually harbored the hepatitis C virus, which is a very hardy virus. And you mentioned HIV and the comparison, the easy comparison of HIV, because we know so much about it, because it's the other most common bloodborne infection. But according to the CDC that you talked about, our estimates, which is based on NHANES data, which is a national household survey data, it's only conservative estimates of what hepatitis C virus is in the United States. And the conservative estimate is that at least four times as many people are living with hepatitis C than HIV, of which, like you said, 75% are undiagnosed. And so bringing back to your dad, we talked about, like, there were preventative things that possibly could have been done. And when we look at head something been done or he had been diagnosed earlier, he may not have developed, in your dad's case, it was hepatocellular carcinoma. Mm-hmm. What do you remember the 10 years ago when he said that he knew he had it, but it was kind of just like, it's just something that we have. What do you remember your response being, or your family's response being, and your dad's response being?
I mean, I remember just being like, hepatitis C, like, it's kind of gross. Like, what is that? You know, I really didn't know anything about it. And we really... You know, of course, if we could have changed things, we'd go back and we'd dive into every book possible. We'd get second opinions. We'd talk to specialists. We'd do all the things that his physician should have done, quite frankly,
yes.
And referred him to someone. And so there's, I think, a huge learning curve for the media, for the public, for our policymakers, and for medical professionals. And I think it's across the board. So, I mean, policymakers, when we're talking about the task force in a little while, but my husband, Representative Mike McAuliffe, you know, he had the idea to introduce a hepatitis C task force, because after going to doctor's appointment after doctor's appointment, once we found out what he had, the liver specialist said, I'm seeing so many cases like this. And it's a shame, because these people are coming to me when it's too late. If they would have come to me 5 years ago, 10 years ago, we wouldn't be talking about transplants. We wouldn't be talking about people dying.
Ascites, variceal bleeds, esophageal bleeds, liver failure, liver cancer. So many things that could be prevented, like that doctor said. But you said you didn't know much when you were young, or 10 years ago when he told you. But you knew enough to kind of be like, ooh, what is that?
Right.
You didn't know much, but you knew enough.
Right.
I guess I would ask, do you see that? Did you see that with your family? Do you see that in the general culture of kind of like, well, I don't know much about that, but ooh.
Yeah, we didn't talk about it. You know, it was almost like, I compare it to like in the 80s when I was growing up and we heard about HIV first. I mean, you didn't want to be in the same room with someone with HIV because we were ignorant. We weren't educated about it. We didn't even really know what it was. We just knew the stigma. And I look at that really in parallel with hepatitis C, because it's pretty much the same thing. So it's okay if you have hepatitis C. And quite frankly, I don't really care how my dad got it. We believe he got it when he was in Vietnam, when he, you know, enlisted. We'll never know, because how do you ever really know? But, you know, we were, my husband and I were watching the news about a year ago, and when the CDC came out with its new recommendations that all baby boomers be tested for hepatitis C. And the main anchor said, which still baffles me to this day, she talked about how there's new guidelines for testing, and then she said, and hepatitis C is prevalent among people who use drugs and casual sex. I'm like, well, okay, those are maybe two reasons. Like, those are two of the risk factors, but that's not the majority. And there's a whole other story that we're not telling. So even the media is biased against hepatitis C, and they're not really presenting the full story. So, and that's where most people get their information.
Right.
So there's a huge learning curve, I think, for, I mentioned the groups, the media, policymakers, the public, and our medical professionals, to make sure that they know what hepatitis C is, and more importantly, what can we do to tackle this? What can we do to face this head on and help fix it and save people's lives?
Well, and knowing that, and Representative Michael McAuliffe, if you were watching the same piece with Kim, what, you know, given the position you have as a politician in Illinois, what, how did this hit you personally, besides this was your father-in-law that had passed, and how would you, were you able to use your political influence to do something?
Yeah, after my father-in-law passed away and seeing how he passed away, and it was something new for me to learn about hepatitis C. My uncle, about a year later, came up to me and told me that he had hepatitis C. He was getting treated for it. It was out of his system for about a year, and it came back. And I think he was looking at my father-in-law, being about the same age, 60 years old at that time, and thinking, this is going to be me. I'm going to be just like your father-in-law, and I don't have much longer to live, or he didn't know what the future held. So he told me in confidence, and then he passed away a couple of months later, last May. I was down in Springfield. I remember waking up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and we had, I thought about doing a task force about hepatitis C. leading into that time, my wife and her brothers and family and friends were just all talking about this hepatitis C and why did people get it? What can we do? What can we do to prevent other people that have this disease or virus that are walking around that don't even know it? What can we do to educate them? And that's when I thought coming up with a task force would answer a lot of the questions that we were asking amongst ourselves. So my idea was to get a bunch of professionals together, some legislators. I did find out a state legislator had hepatitis C, and he admitted that in front of our the committee that we had to pass the bill out of. So in a short amount of time, too, when I introduced the bill and got it passed in a couple of days, I had different people in Springfield, secretaries whose brothers died of hepatitis C, and they were all quiet about it. I mean, I can't tell you how many different walks of life of people that came to me that died of hepatitis C. I know some that were in their 80s and some that were younger. And they said, and maybe they didn't tell everybody at the, when the person passed away or at the funeral or at the wake services how a person died, because there's a stigma to it. And just like my wife said last year when they talked about it on TV, they want to make it look like anyone that lived in a Woodstock generation are the people that got hepatitis C, and it's not true.
Thank you. I'm thrilled that you were able to use your position to create that. Can you talk a little bit about how easy or hard it was in the political process to pass that task force through?
It wasn't difficult except for the time constraint. We were going to adjourn in about 4 or 5 days, so we had to move quickly. It was just something that was wrestling around in my mind, and I didn't think of, I wanted to pass a bill to do a task force to go back to the General Assembly, see if there's legislation that we can do to get more people aware if they have hepatitis C, and also to put, you know, find out more about screening, affordability. So while we were writing the bill together, again, we were running out of time. Of course, the legislature was dealing with, you know, our budget at the time. That was the end of the spring session. Also, that time, pensions and a lot of other important matters, too. So it was something that we had to put together very, very quickly. We got unanimous support from the Senate and the House, and we had a lot of cooperation. And that's when I found out, again, that one of my fellow colleagues has hepatitis C and was supposed to start a treatment as soon as we finished our spring session. So it was just difficult in the time, but people want to help. They want to learn more about it. Since that time, I've had other legislators they've had like small conferences dealing with hepatitis C because they know it's prevalent in just not only as for veterans, but in the African-American community. So the Black Caucus, the Illinois Black Caucus, which consists of Black legislators, they talk about issues that come in front of their communities. And one of the issues was hepatitis C. And I walked in and talked to them and let them know that I'm also, aware of hepatitis C, and I want to, you know, I want us to all join together so we can get to this common goal of letting people know who have hepatitis C, that they have it, what treatments are out there, and how this can impact their life, because it is a deadly disease.
That can be cured.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So, Kim, knowing that you have a political partner, and you yourself work in, what's your field?
Public affairs.
Public affairs. It's communication. So, help the people who are living with Hep C who haven't talked about it, people like me who are an advocate on the ground, make this whole task force and the legislative part less daunting. How can people on the, you know, ground level who are living, who want to do something about it, do something with this task force?
That's a great question. The best thing that people could do is become their own advocates, whether you have hepatitis C, whether you know someone who has it, whether you just care about public health, contact your legislator. call your state representative, call your state senator, send them an email. I'd love it if you can go in and set up a meeting with them in their district and talk to them about the need for increasing awareness about hepatitis C. If not, just send them an email and just say, listen, hepatitis C is very important to me. I know there's this task force that's going on in Illinois. Please pay attention to any legislation that comes out of it and support hepatitis C regulations. I mean, at the end of the day, we want to make sure that people know about hepatitis C, that they have the resources to get tested. And we know that we're talking about some demographics that don't have the resources or the means, that maybe they don't have the insurance that they would like to have, to get tested. So we want to make sure that those people who don't have the resources, they're not discriminated against, that you can still get tested and find out if you have hepatitis C. So there's, I think, going to be a lot of good public policy that's going to come out of the task force. And it's going to impact every single person in this state. And if they can reach out to their legislators and let them know that they're interested in this issue, that would be a huge help for us. Because we need to start talking about it.
Yeah, and just to be clear, again, so if I'm a community member, is my only access to the task force through my legislator? Or can I, as a community member, maybe have my voice heard in the task force or have my story or statistics even sent to the task force? So do I have to go through my legislator or a politician?
Well, they're public meetings.
They're public
meetings.
So anyone's
able to come to the meeting. But I think at the end of the day, the work of the task force, so the task force is going to make a recommendation to the General Assembly. So they might recommend three pieces of legislation that pass to help people with hepatitis to become aware they have hepatitis C, or maybe it's helping people that already have hepatitis C. Maybe it's adding funding for not-for-profits to help on the ground in the communities at a grassroots level of prevention, whatever the legislation might end up being. Their representative is going to have to vote yes or no on it. And there might be some tough decisions because there's different interests. Maybe it's an insurance issue and the insurance companies might not want the bill to pass. So their voice is going to be critical when we take this to the General Assembly as a whole for a member to say, okay, I got 50 calls at my office about this bill. My constituency really cares about this. I should vote for this. Because at the end of the day, our elected officials are there to represent us. They're supposed to be carry our voices to Springfield.
Yes.
And I think that's become educated and arm yourself with knowledge and reach out to your legislator.
And I think, and thanks for breaking that down. I mean, I think making a phone call seems a little less daunting for a community member. Mm-hmm. Representative, could you tell us, so if I'm going to make a call to your office, I mean, what am I going to expect? Are you really going to hear me, what I have to say? Does it have to be like this conversation? Do I just call and say, hey, my name's Jill and this is my situation? I mean, is it a scary process for a community member?
I don't believe so. Of course, I get so many calls from people that live in my 20th legislative district, but I get calls from all over the state. And I think a lot of people would be surprised if they're asking for information or something like about hepatitis C that, you know, most if not all lawmakers will call them back, especially something so sensitive like this. Mm-hmm. We're looking forward to getting the task force assembled. It took some time to get the right people in place. Hopefully we're going to have our first meeting in the next month. And then from there, if a community member or somebody wants to tell their story, they can maybe, once the task force meets, maybe we'll have a day where they can have human interest stories where we want to hear back from people. And even if somebody couldn't physically be there, they can send a transcript over, and then that could be read into the record too, and all the members of the task force can see that. If you have access to a computer, all you need to do is go into the Illinois General Assembly homepage and just do a little bit of click on homework and look at committees or the task force, and you can see when the meetings will be available. These aren't closed to the public. And I think in our case, there would be a notice that it would be like way ahead of time, where some other committees maybe meet a lot more frequently, weekly, that maybe people don't have the time to do it. And we'd like to have some in Springfield, have some up here in Chicago, and maybe some other parts of the state, too. If necessary, we may do that, too.
Well, and there are a lot of, you know, so-called experts on the task force, which is a good thing, but there really is nothing without the voices of the people who are directly impacted by it, which is the families and the people themselves. So clearly and certainly we need to hear from those people and hear about their experiences. You know, for us, my dad It's a very painful, it's a very crippling, it's a very paralyzing virus. And when you hear virus, you think, oh, mm-hmm. virus is something. Well, it'll be gone in 24 hours or 48 hours. No, this is a blood disease, and it's very serious. And, you know, we were in Puerto Rico the December before my dad passed away, and he was swimming laps in the pool.
Mm. Was 4 or 5 months before he passed?
It was 4 months before he passed.
Wow.
So just the progression of his illness was mind-blowing. And when we look at pictures, you know, it's hard to look at pictures because he was very strong and very convicted. And I know if he could have changed things, he would have. I mean, we've had that conversation. And when he was told that he really didn't have much longer to live, you know, he jumped up off the table. He said, okay, thanks. And we're like, what do you mean, okay, thanks? Because what am I going to do? He's like, I'm dying. So, I mean, just he was so strong. And to picture someone like that deteriorating so quickly makes it difficult. So I think for people who are facing the question, should I get screened? If you are a baby boomer, get screened. That's the CDC is recommending that all baby boomers get tested. And it's not just a virus that, you know, goes away on its own. If there are dire consequences if you do not get the proper treatment that you need. And this is something that we can cure. This is something that is manageable, something that you can live with. You don't want to be in the situation like we were in, where you wish you could have done something different, and then by then it's too late and there's nothing that you can do. But it's painful. You know, your organs shut down. You're in and out of the hospital a lot. It's very difficult on families. I had a almost 2-year-old, and I was pregnant when my dad was dying in the hospital. And I know that he held on to see my daughter born. And he passed away about 3 weeks after my daughter was born. But I know he held on with every ounce of fiber in his body, with every bit of strength he had left. He just wanted to see her born. But, I mean, we all knew that the consequences and the end result was going to be the same. And if we could help other families avoid that pain, and it's not only the person that has the hepatitis C that goes through all that, it's the families. Because hopefully you have the support system that my dad had, and you've got, you know, children or friends and family who care about you. But, you know, when that person's gone, it's like you're faced to live with, what if I would have been more involved? What if I would have known more about hepatitis C? You know, I never forgot the day when they told us my dad wasn't eligible for a transplant. I mean, it was like someone, you know, punching you in the stomach. I mean, if you're at a point in your life where your only prayer of seeing tomorrow is a transplant, I mean, that's still no walk in the park. I mean, that's still very serious. But that's where we were at. We were looking at going out of the country for different treatments. We were looking for anyone who would tell us anything other than, this is terminal, he's not going to survive. So if you're listening to this and you have a family member, maybe it's you yourself, and you're thinking, well, you know what, I did have a blood transfusion, or maybe I did use drugs with a needle. We're not here to judge.
Snorted cocaine once with someone and shared a straw.
Totally.
Or I did a homemade tattoo. Or I pierced myself and then pierced you.
Right.
Right?
Right. The prison population is another at-risk group. So the bottom line is, I know I don't care how you got it, other than preventing it in the future. But we're not here to judge people. If you've contracted hepatitis C, let's figure out how we can work together to fix it and to make it manageable so you can live. And future generations moving forward, let's create awareness about some of the ways that you can prevent contracting hepatitis C in the first place.
And so that's some great messages to an individual who doesn't know their status or who does. What would you say to family members who, hopefully they know their status, so assuming they know their status, mm-hmm. what would you say to family members or friends and what they can do or be aware of?
You don't pretend like it's going to go away, because it's not. I mean, inaction is going to lead to death. You really have to become a strong advocate. And if the person that you care about doesn't want treatment, you have to push them, because you don't want to be in a situation where you wish you could have done more, because once it's over, it's over. You know, we only have one chance at life. And it's certainly taught my family and I to appreciate every day as a blessing, because it is. Because there are no, you know, in the playground when you're younger, I want a do-over. You know, there are no do-overs in life. You've got one shot at it. So you got to be your own advocate, and you've got to become educated. And hepatitis C, it really doesn't have to be the end of the world.
Not at all.
So I think hopefully what part of what we can do with the task force and working with you, Jill, with the Caring Ambassadors, is to make it socially acceptable to have hepatitis C. So the reaction wasn't like mine when I found out my dad had hepatitis C. It was like, ooh, really? The reaction is, oh, you know, you can treat that. So it's more of a positive thing, and that's, I think, one of the as long as I have some control on the task force, one of the goals of the task force will be to make it a socially acceptable, similar to what they did with HIV.
Mm-hmm. That's partly why we're here, which thank you again for that. Where would you like to see the task force in a, you know, magic wand question, maybe a year, 2 years, 3 years from now? What effect would you like to see the task force have on Illinois public health?
Well, first of all, I would like to see those numbers change, especially in Illinois, that if you have hepatitis C, that you know it. Going back to with the task force, beside my father-in-law and my uncle passing away with the complications and that from hepatitis C, I remember driving around the city and seeing the CDC having advertisements on the bus shelter saying if you were born between the years 1945 and 1965, you are at high risk for hepatitis C and you need to be screened. And you can't just go to your doctor and go for your physical and they say everything is fine. From what I understand, you have to get a special testing for this. So people will get a call from the doctor and say, oh, everything's good till next year. So I think people in that age group that were born those years should be tested for hepatitis C. So that would be one thing I would look forward to. And also to make sure that everybody that falls in that age group gets tested, and it's not a financial issue, too.
And with that, and thank you for saying that, because many people say, oh, yeah, I just went to the doctor. They did all my liver enzymes, which hepatitis C affects the liver. Hepatitis means liver inflammation. But you actually have to ask for a specific hepatitis C antibody testing. You have to actually ask for that at this point. So maybe that's some work we can do on the task force, too. Maybe just changing some Illinois, because doctors need to know this as well. One thing I wanted to ask you, Kim, you had talked about we talked about elements of prevention, because by the time your dad got to the point, especially where he needed a liver transplant and it didn't, it went beyond his liver, the cancer. So he wasn't a candidate for that. What do you think, his doctor should have said to him in terms of things he could have done, general knowledge or family knowledge of how to better take care of your liver, things that he maybe could have done to take care of his liver had he known or had you known?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think the best thing people can do is become their own self-advocates, because, I mean, doctors, you know, do the best they can, but that's not always enough. And I think for us to put our lives in the hands of someone else, you're taking a risk.
Yes.
So I do believe that if you find out whether it's anything, whether it's hepatitis C, whether it's you know, something else that you have wrong with your body, you know, do your research, do your due diligence, and know what your options are. And I know that a part of the task force is going to be to make sure that the medical professionals really, really, really understand and practice the standard of care. So when you find out that someone has hepatitis C, you need to refer them to a specialist. You need to refer them to a liver specialist. You need to refer them to someone who's going to do the proper screenings. Because you do. You need to make sure that you're screening on a regular basis, your blood levels, to see, you know, where your alpha theta protein markers are and the various triggers that tell you about cancer, about your liver function. That's not something that a primary everyday doctor necessarily specializes in. So as a person, I like to put the power back in the people, in mm-hmm. the person. And if you find out you have hepatitis C, then I think it's up to you as a patient, as your own advocate, to make sure that you are referred to a specialist. And if your doctor tells you have hepatitis C, tell him you want to see a specialist. And I think that's really what you need to do, because we're seeing so much more of this. My dad's doctors, he ended up at Northwestern, although we researched every hospital literally in the world. We were going to go to Japan and get treatment in Japan. But we ended up at Northwestern. They have some of the best doctors in this field at Northwestern. And my dad's liver specialist, she said that she wishes that this wasn't the case that she sees all the time, because these people that are coming in, my dad was 61 years old when he passed away. Michael's uncle was 60. They had a lot of living to do. My dad wanted was grandkids. That's all he kept talking about was grandkids. And he's lived, my son was two. He actually died on my son's second birthday. Which I think is actually special in a way. I know people are like, oh, that's sad. But I think it's a good way of reminding us, not that we need a reminder that, you know, of who he is, but just reminding us of the significance in all of our lives. And the task force meeting, the first one, is actually on my dad's birthday, which staff picked that date. We didn't even pick the date. And when they said it was February 5th, I'm like, you got to be kidding me. I'm like, so there's all these, you know, triggers that keep bringing me back to my dad. But I just think, back to your question, is just making sure that you're, you know, you become your own advocate and you make sure that you're getting the treatment you need and being referred to a specialist.
A great answer from an advocate. I mean, at Caring Ambassadors, we say being your own health ambassador and finding out what that means. And the fact is that you're right. Our primary general physicians, they can test for the antibodies, they can confirm, and they can do some simple behavioral modifications and education on that, and then the specialist needs to come into place. Mm-hmm. And some of those behavioral modifications, very easy, is regardless of what kind of hepatitis you have, inflammation of the liver, any kind of alcohol is like adding gasoline to a fire on your liver. So one thing is avoiding all alcohol if possible, and if not, then moderation at extreme, but it's recommended to have none. Watching, you know, your diet, of course, and exercise is huge, and reducing the amount of inflammation in your body. Making sure that you're taking general good care, getting sleep and exercise, of course. And these things seems like a no duh, but it's hard to do when you really integrate it. And these are things that our primary care physicians can educate our patients on and encourage them to go be ambassadors to their own health, as you said yourself.
Right. And even prescription drugs. I mean, some of those drugs, your liver has a problem processing some of the drugs that you're taking. So it really takes someone that knows the liver very, very well and hepatitis C very well to be able to say to you, listen, I know you've been doing this for 10 years, but this is not the best for your liver. Let's switch to this. It could be simple adjustments or changes in your life that can make your liver function a lot better.
Absolutely. How would you say, you know, we've talked a lot about public health and a lot about people in the community, patients who are living with it, but let's go back to, you know, your unique individual family. And what would you say was the impact on your immediate family? Obviously, you had just had a baby and huge change in your family. But then also, you know, your extended family with your siblings and your mother and then, of course, your husband's family going through something similar. What was the familial impact there?
You know, it was very difficult because, you know, well, one, I was pregnant with my daughter and I had a 2-year-old at home and I have my own business. So life generally on a day-to-day basis is completely insane. So then, and I traveled a lot at that time, but I actually took off, I changed my travel schedule so I was home more so I could help with my dad. My brothers live with my dad to help him. Mm-hmm. And so they really made a lot of sacrifices and they, you know, they're the ones who help, you know, bathe him and, you know, when he fell, helping him get up and, you know, when he doesn't remembering where he was at or what he was doing, they're the ones who said, okay, Dad, like, don't worry, you're at home. When he started to get increased levels of pneumonia in his body, you could tell right away he started talking crazy. It was almost like he was a different person and he was babbling and wasn't making any sense. So my brothers knew then, okay, his levels are off. We got to take him to the emergency room. So it was a lot of in and out of the hospital. And my brothers really carried most of the burden with that and did a fantastic job. So, I mean, everybody contributes to it at a different level. You know, everybody does everything they can do financially. You know, my dad had his own business and he couldn't work. You know, he could barely, you know, walk down the stairs, let alone work. So it impacted us in a lot of different ways. I would say the most significant, though, was obviously the emotional toll and the hole that it left in all of our lives. I mean, my dad was always a very strong personality. You know, everyone knew he was in the room. It was fun. You know, he had a lot of energy and a lot of life. And so not having that anymore, obviously the holidays are always very difficult, you know, birthdays, the milestones like you think about, but the hardest part of it is wondering if things could have maybe been done a little bit differently. And so you go through these different stages of grieving, you know, first you're like, you're sad and then you get angry and then you wonder like, okay, what could I have done differently? You know, being a person that's a big proponent of being a self-advocate, it's like, okay, I'm not going to blame anybody. Like, what could we have done differently? There's, you know, where do we go wrong here? And I think, you know, there's not really a good answer to any of those questions. And I know like from, you know, Michael maybe have a different perspective with this, but watching us all go through this, I mean, my brothers and I had arguments about how to tell my dad he was even dying. I mean, because we knew he was dying right before Christmas of 2010. And we're like, well, do we tell him? Do we wait? I mean, it's his life, but let's get through the holidays. Let's just enjoy the holidays. But how do you enjoy the holidays when you know your dad's dying and he doesn't? So it almost, you felt like you were maybe playing God because you're not telling someone. So we had, there's a lot of emotional conflict, and it's just difficult. So,
and Michael, I'm curious, you know, having a strong wife who had it all together, and has it all together, what was it like for you to see her going through this and the impact on you as a spouse and a parent?
It was tough. And then with my travel schedule, when we found out that my father-in-law was, you know, was really pretty sick after we came back from that vacation in December. So let's go back to January before he passes away in April. I'm going down to Springfield. My wife is pregnant, due in 2 months. You know, and then with my father-in-law, when he gets sick and has to go to the hospital, it's not a scheduled appointment. It could happen at midnight. We'll talk to my brother-in-law. He had to take Dad in to the, you know, into the emergency room or to get treated. Some of the things I remember, too, was that the first time that my father-in-law seen my daughter, he was across the street at the same hospital getting a treatment, mm-hmm. and he came across the street to see his granddaughter. And then I remember telling him that that her middle name was after my father-in-law's mother, Rose. And just, you know, there's in the timing aspect, and I know my wife and brother-in-law's had a lot going on, so I tried to do things that I tried to anticipate some things that were coming up. And you know, we wanted to make sure that my father-in-law seen my daughter baptized. Well, normally that you wait about 2 months because you want the baby to be in the house. You don't want the baby to go outside. I talked to our pastor at the local parish and explained the situation. We had to actually change it, like I think once or twice, where we had to have it pretty quick. And normally there was no invitations. It was just calling people up, say, we want to have our daughter baptized in front of her, you know, her grandfather, and we wanted to make sure he's there. And we had to change it, like, I think 2 times, and, you know, we were able to do that. And I think that was special for everyone, and that's something that you look back at later on, and you're happy that he was there. But at the time, it's just, it's a lot of confusion because it's hard to plan things.
Because you don't, like, you know they're dying, but you don't know when, and you don't ever really think it's going to happen. You know,
how do you plan?
Yeah, you hope it's not going to happen. So we, you know, we called the priest on a Sunday, and she was baptized the next day because we didn't want to overreact. It's like, well, you know, he's going to be around. And then it got to the point to where they're like, you know, it could be days. And then so my daughter was about 2 weeks old, and I took her over to, I slept over at my dad's house on the couch the day before he died. And I brought my daughter. She slept in her little bassinet right next to me. And my dad was like, at that point, he wasn't, you know, he was in hospice and he wasn't talking. And there was no, you know, response or anything. My daughter slept right next to me, and we were on the couch. And of course, I mean, you're like, is he breathing? Is he awake? Is he alive? I mean, that feeling right there of anyone who's had a family member that's go through cancer or something that's terminal. I mean, you know what I'm going, you know what we're going through. It's, you're just, when's the last breath going to be the last breath? And I think I think the most special moments was when, is actually the day when he passed away. We were all at the house, and my aunt was in the kitchen, and she's like, you know, I think you guys should all come in here. So my brothers and I were talking about what to put on the prayer card, what prayer to put on the card. My dad was very spiritual. He's very religious. So I had the book, and I had, like, most, if I'm the only girl, I have two brothers. So, like, most only girl in the family would recognize you kind of narrow it down for the guys and, like, give them a la carte things to pick from. So I had narrowed it down to about 4 or 5 different prayers, and we were reading them. And I looked over at my dad, and his breaths were very shallow at this point. And like I said, it could have been hours. We really didn't know when. But I started reading some of the prayers. And I said, well, why don't we combine a couple of them? Because I know he'd like this part, and I think this part's great. So then I looked at my dad, and I said, Dad, I'm like, what do you think? And he, you know, didn't say anything, but he just was there. And then as we read through them again, we decided on what we were going to do. And I literally just looked at my watch a couple minutes before. We were timing his breaths, so we knew he was still breathing. And I looked over to my dad, what do you think about this? And I looked at him, and you could just tell he just passed. And I had my hand on his hand, and it was cold. But it's like he found peace in the fact that we were reading those prayers. So,
and that's when he went.
That's when he passed. Yeah. So it was very, it was actually, if you're going to like, if you have to die, I guess that's probably like a very spiritual, nice way to pass away, because you know he was at peace and he wasn't in any pain. But you know, that's one of the things that I remember, because he was so spiritual and he really took comfort, I think, you know, in his final moments on earth, and knowing that we were all together and that we were being, you know, praying and being spiritual. And I just think about those days, and they seem like they were forever ago. And at the same time, my brothers and I talk about that we still can't believe that he's gone, because we don't really think that he should be. Like, we really, really believe that things could have been different if he would have gotten different types of treatment.
And so your dad, wherever he may be, what do you think he's thinking right now? What do you think is going through his head about what his little girl has done in his honor?
Yeah, I think my brothers and I, and Michael, of course, I think he's proud of all of us. I think he's, you know, my dad always said, he goes, my children are going to make a difference in life. He's like, I know that you guys are going to make a difference and do something good for the people. My dad was always a guy that looked out for the underdog. You know, if you were an underdog, he was in your corner. Like, he wanted to help you out. And he always liked to call, like, the little people, like kids. Like, he loved, you know, empowering kids and making sure that kids had the tools to succeed. It was just his personality. So I know he'd be very proud. And I'm sure, because he was a funny guy. I'm sure he's saying, not at my expense, guys. Couldn't you have done this a little bit sooner? But definitely, I think that he's smiling down on us. And I think he's giving us the strength to move on and to carry out. It's not just his legacy. It's the legacy of everyone who's been impacted by hepatitis C. I mean, veterans, generally speaking, you know, they're out there, they're risking their lives for us. And then they have to come home and fight the war on hepatitis C when they've already given the ultimate sacrifice, as far as I'm concerned. And the fact that we're not educating those people and letting them know that they're at risk and getting them screened, to me, is actually, it's very frustrating to me. So no question, he's proud of us. Like I said, he probably is, like, really at my expense. But I think moving forward, that's what's going to keep this thing. This is what's going to continue to give us momentum. And the fact that there are these dates that keep popping up, mm-hmm. that have something to do with him, I think is just another reminder that he's not gone. He's here. He's pulling the strings.
And so with that, let's sort of end on the main notes that your dad's shouting from through this task force, through you all, through me and my work. What are these main messages we really want to make sure people hear?
I think knowing if you're in the at-risk group, knowing if your family members are in the at-risk group, and let's not complicate things. Let's make it real simple. If you're a baby boomer, get tested. It couldn't be more simple than that. And, you know, go to your doctor. You have to tell them specifically that you want to get tested for hepatitis C, because a general physical, which is another part, I think, of the task force, is to change this. But you go in there and you're being responsible. You're like, I'm going to get my physical. You feel good about it. You get the clean bill of health and you're ready to roll. And then they never tested you for hepatitis C. So right. It's a silent epidemic, which I think is something that we really haven't talked about. There really aren't a lot of warning signs. So you may feel great. You may feel fatigued, which is one of the side effects of hepatitis C. But you could just think, well, who's not fatigued? Everyone's busy, right? Everyone's running around like crazy all the time. So just don't take anything for granted. It's literally a simple blood test. Just make sure when you go in for your regular physical that you request the test. Or if you're in between physicals, make it a point to go in specifically and ask for screening for hepatitis C.
And if you are diagnosed positive, there's very easy behavioral techniques you can do to help your liver. There is curative treatment options out there. And if you've been cured of hepatitis C, it's important to know to get your liver checked at least every 6 months, just to make sure that you are free of any kind of cancer. It does reduce your risk, but you are still at risk. So,
and we want to hear these stories. I mean, I think the biggest, one of the best things that we can do is let people know it's okay. You know, if you have hepatitis C, don't be embarrassed. Don't be ashamed. Talk about it, because you're going to be helping somebody else. And I think that the more we make people comfortable with the fact that if they have hepatitis C, it's okay, the more we're going to start the dialogue. And I want to commend StoryCorps and Caring Ambassadors for allowing us this opportunity, because I really feel like this is one of the first things that we're doing to really broadcast this, and I'm hopeful that we're going to get a lot of media attention from mainstream media, and obviously with policymakers, so we can shout from the rooftop that, hey, if you have hepatitis C, it doesn't have to be the end of the world. Just get the proper screening and prevention, and you'll be okay.
Take action.
Well, what was your father's name?
Ross.
Ross?
Mm-hmm. Morielli?
Right, yeah.
And what is your fondest memory of him when you were a little girl?
entertaining.
Yeah. My dad was a character. He was, he just, you know, he was an old school Italian. He, you know, every other word out of his mouth began with the letter F. And, but that was just his personality, you know, and he was just loud. He's this, like, you know, loud, larger than life guy. I remember being on the phone with my girlfriends and they're like, is your dad yelling? I'm like, no, he's just talking. Cause this is how we talk. Like, he was just a loud guy, but I was a competitive figure skater growing up and he was very involved with us growing up and he never missed one of my skating competitions. So he was at every, whether it was in Dallas, whether it was in Detroit, no matter where we were at, he was there all the time. And he always, taught us to have confidence in ourselves and that we could do anything. Anything's possible. And he used to say, the only one who can beat you is you. You know, you can accomplish anything you want. You're going to get in your own way if you're not, you know, going to be 100% confident in yourself. And he had all kinds of fun little sayings, you know, don't be me, be better than me. So he really, like, tried to raise us and groom us to be the best that we could have been and to reach our maximum potential. So just, I guess, his philosophy and his, you know, the way he brought us up was, I say some of the things to my kids. My son's only three. But we always say, treat people the way you want to be treated. That was my dad's golden rule. So I say to my son, I'm like, treat people. He's like, the way you want to be treated. That's what grandpa says. I'm like, yep, that's what grandpa says. So
that's awesome. Thanks, yeah. Ross, for, taught you to change the world. I mean, we are. So thank you both for using your position and your emotion to help others. Your dad is proud.
Yeah, I just have to add one more thing. I know we're probably running out of time, but Michael had the vision of the task force, and it was a bipartisan effort to get it passed. And this is an issue, I think, that sees beyond politics. In a time when we're going into an election year, you know, this has nothing to do with politics. This has everything to do with good policy. And this was an issue where everybody came together in a bipartisan way. It passed unanimously in the House and the Senate. And a very good friend of ours, Representative Dan Burke, who's in leadership on the House and the Dem side, you know, he was one of the first ones to step up. He knew my dad, and he couldn't believe that my dad was dying. He's like, your daddy's like, he's so young. He has so much energy. So he stepped up and he helped get this through the House in 3 days. And when you asked Michael about how hard it was, I think he was being modest. It was hard. Bills don't pass out of both chambers in 3 days. You don't take a bill from inception to passage in 3 days. It just does not happen, especially at the end of a legislative session when you're dealing with really, really, really heavy issues that have been, you know, procrastinated on forever, whether it's pensions or, you know, civil unions or whatever the bill might be. You don't deal with issues like this. So for this to get passed, it was truly a bipartisan effort in both the House and the Senate. And when we asked the Senate sponsor, State Senator Tony Munoz, to pick up the bill and Senator Pam Althoff up from McHenry, without even batting an eye, they said, absolutely, we're going to do it. So this is an issue I think that can bring everybody together and really see through all the politics. And it's going to be a rough year of politics. I mean, we're in an election year. So this is something I think that can really keep people together and focused on a common good that can ultimately, I know this is going to benefit people, and I am confident this is going to save people's lives.